For millennia, sailors of the North Atlantic whispered of the Kraken, vast, coiled monstrosities lurking beneath the waves, big enough to drag ships into their depths or blot out the sun with their writhing arms. The stories, passed around damp decks under flickering oil lamps, were dismissed by naturalists as drunken fantasy or metaphor gone mad. But the stomachs of sperm whales hinted at something else. Harpooners carving into whale carcasses found massive, chitinous beaks, curved, hard, similar to the beak on a squid. Did you know squids have beaks? They have beaks. But wholly out of scale with any known squid, naturalists took note of enormous, parrot-like beaks, cataloged the oddities, then shrugged. The Kraken was a sailor's tale. Then, in 1861, the French corvette Alecton stumbled across a dying, half-floating mass off the Canary Islands, arms trailing, body pulped, but unmistakably colossal. The sailors tried to haul it aboard. It broke apart. But a piece was brought back to Paris, and suddenly, myth had a name, the giant squid, Architeuthis dux. Everyone knows by now that this is most likely where the myth of the Kraken came from. Long ago in the mists of time, some Vikings out on the sea came across a dead or half-alive giant squid and thought, I sure am glad we don't have to fight one of those. But they never did have to fight one of those. There was no record of any human ever having seen a living giant squid until the 21st century. The squids kept to themselves, way down in the depths. But the eeriest thing of all is how close we came to hunting the Kraken into existence by clearing the ocean so effectively that the myth of Kraken stealing sailors off decks nearly became reality. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. These are my co-hosts, Jollibee the Durian, Thimble the Doll, and now, Sluds the Shoggoth. And welcome back, after a long, by my standards, break, to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. Feels like it's been so long since I've done an episode. I've been traveling, I've been sick on and off, and just really sure does feel great to be back on set with Thimble and Jollibee, and we have a new curiosity in the cabinet. Introducing Sluds, the Shoggoth. Figured this would be an apropos episode in which to debut Sluds. Way back in my 50k subscriber special, I said I wanted a plush Shoggoth, which is a creature from Lovecraft that some people use as a metaphor for the danger of unaligned AI. And I was like, I'm not even sure you can buy a plush Shoggoth, but I want one. And then a friend in London took it on herself to make one. And as I was passing through a week ago on my way to see my co-writer Nick in Edinburgh, I picked up Sluds. Anne, who meticulously needle-felted this Shoggoth into existence, says that she intended this Shoggoth to be somewhat feminine-looking. Okay, sure. Her name is Mrs. Sluds, which, considering that my Reddit username is Mr. Sluds, I'm not sure I like what's being implied there, but I'm equally unsure I don't like it. Fan art! There's been a lot of it! Zuzu made this cheesy take on Jollibee that makes me go mamma mia. Damien drew Jollibee and the gay little water bottle, as it's now semi-officially known. Damien also did Chinese Tor, in which instead of being from Oregon and studying abroad in China and coming back with a plastic durian named Jollibee, this dude is from China and studied abroad in Oregon and came back with a plastic corn cob named Applebee. Mere World Clement says, oh no, oh god, what the fuck is Jollibee doing? Tam Rhoda did Rat Tor. I'm the giant rat that makes all the rules, I guess. Mareep made Jollibee and Thimble thirst traps that, oh god, oh, I don't want to think about this, get this off my screen. This is an interesting take on Thimble from a user only known as 014. Never thought I'd see my doll looking so much like Geralt of Rivia. Meerkat says, this fruit stand ain't big enough for the both of us. Damien's back with an unsettling final project from his Photoshop class, and Jasper's painted Jollibee. He'll be sending me this painting soon, and I will put it on my wall in a place of honor. Thank you for all the fan art. You can submit it on the Taurus Cabinet Discord, which you get access to by contributing to the Taurus Cabinet Patreon. On with the episode. First, let's be clear about what this won't be. This isn't a foray into cryptozoology. There are no real Shoggoths here. No talk of aircraft carrier sinking tentacled sea gods worshipped by secret island cults. No government-suppressed leviathans. No blurry sonar images passed off as the truth. The reality, as always, is far stranger and far more terrifying without embellishment. Even the smallest of the large-bodied open ocean squids, like the Humboldt squid, is already human size. They weigh as much as an adult human, even though they don't have any bones. Agile, strong, and unnervingly intelligent, they hunt in packs and communicate by rapidly changing the color of their bodies. Some adventurous divers in the Gulf of California have had close calls, wrapped in tentacles, bitten, or getting their diving gear nearly peeled away like fruit skin.
It just actually bit me right through the chainmail suit!
The true deep sea giants, colossal and giant squids, reach lengths well over 10 meters. They need no mythic inflation. All it takes is a single stray specimen surfacing in the far north near the edge of Arctic ice, where the boundary between surface and deep becomes meaningless. It's just as dark, just as cold, just as hostile 10 meters down as it is 10,000. In that setting, the image of a sailor pulled screaming from the low deck of a Norse longship isn't fantasy, it's a rare but possible event. Of course, in modern times, with our hundreds of yards long steel ships, creatures like these pose no real threat to humans. And squid big enough to truly endanger such ships? Not plausible. Not because of scale, but because they'd just never be able to lift themselves far enough out of the water. Physics and physiology don't permit it. So, let's turn back the wheel of time and talk about why I said we nearly hunted krakens into existence. Way back as the asteroid wiped out most of life 65 million years ago in the KT extinction event, sea life was not spared. Most land-dwelling lineages that survived can be traced back to small burrowing ancestors, while animals that survived in the sea survived for different reasons. In the sea, organisms with low metabolisms and long lifespans persisted, and descendants of these slow, lumbering creatures colonized the niches wiped clean of life by the asteroid impact and its long winter. Such organisms tend to be found in layers of water that light doesn't reach. Before the asteroid impact, in the Cretaceous, these deep-sea species had no hope of becoming apex predators on surface waters, dominated by the likes of mosasaurids, which are shark-like aquatic reptiles. When those went extinct, though, all the seas belonged to the deep-sea giants. Giant squid, or proto-giant squid, could have easily occupied the surface apex predator niche for millions of years. Sharks of similar size were around, but they posed no real risk to a big cephalopod. Yes, sharks are exquisitely optimized for low drag and efficient swimming, but they're not remotely dexterous. Once they bite, they shear away flesh by violently shaking their heads. That efficiency is wasted on prey that can grapple back. If the first bite or the bleeding it causes isn't fatal, the shark is stuck, held, entangled, unable to deliver a second bite, and worse, unable to breathe. Water stops flowing through the gills when the shark stops moving. Against a squid that can wrap, resist, and even retaliate, the shark becomes the prey. Even primitive non-echolocating whales likely only challenged squids. They didn't dominate them. It's probably no coincidence that basilosaurids, ancient snake-bodied marine mammals arguably considered the first whales, retained their long, undulating forms for over 10 million years. It wasn't inefficiency, it was survival design. An eel-like body allows a predator like a toothed whale to bite and thrash even when entangled, a trait that matters more than streamlining when your enemy can wrap you in its arms and pull. Still, This only put them on equal footing with giant squid. Squid are extremely intelligent, capable of cooperative hunting and rapid communication. The whales never evolved to win the physical arms race. When they won, it was due to superior sensory abilities. Echolocation. Sonar probably first evolved in small-bodied cetaceans, not for hunting, but for evading predators. These small proto-baleen whales needed to hide from the visually hunting Bacillosaurus above and the grappling squid below. Even a crude form of sonar could provide early warning, a blurry echo in the dark, just enough to escape. But basilosaurids lacked a niche to evolve into after their prey adapted. Unlike squids, they couldn't retreat into abyssal depths or ice-tinged water columns. They were trapped in the surface waters where they had evolved to live, and starved out by prey that became too agile, too evasive, too smart. When echolocation gave cetaceans sensory supremacy over the squid, the direction of their evolution shifted. They could afford to become streamlined and fast. They didn't need to win fights with giant squids anymore. They could simply avoid them. So, what likely ended the surface presence of giant squid and forced them back down to the depths wasn't climate or competition from sharks, it was the rise of huge predatory echolocating whales, including sperm whales. These were predators equipped with teeth, sonar, and speed, and they could go where Basilosaurus never could. During the Quaternary glaciation, when Earth entered an alternating pattern of ice ages and warm periods that technically were still in, the climate upheaval wiped out sperm whales' main prey, the small baleen whales of old. And as that era closed, something else opened. Vast ice shelves formed over the surface of the ocean, turning the water frigid and lightless. To a cephalopod, like a squid, the oceans became a surface-level abyss. This allowed sperm whales to evolve for hunting giant squids, as they had some access to such prey near the surface. Thus, they could slowly be selected for increasing dive depth and improving echolocation. Now, sperm whales fight giant squid once again. Nobody's ever observed it, but squid remains in whales' stomachs, and injuries on whales from the squid suckers tell the tale. The giant squid is no longer an apex predator. For now, the whales have won. Of course, all of this is just recent biological history, measured in quick ticks of deep time. The fossil record carries echoes far older. Soft-bodied organisms like squid, especially those adapted to abyssal depths, rarely fossilize, if at all. But fossils aren't the only way we can learn about extinct animals. There's a lot more shots in the dark involved, but you can make educated guesses about ancient species by looking at the animals we do know from around their time and asking, why did this creature evolve the way it did? What sort of environment sculpted an organism like this? And while we may never find concrete evidence, there's reason to believe giant squid's influence lingers in the evolutionary patterns of the predators they fought. After every mass extinction event, the group of animals that rose to become apex predators in the surface oceans share something strange in common. They weren't optimized for swimming. For tens of millions of years after each extinction, the ruling predators were inefficient movers. From early ichthyosaurs to plesiosaurs and pleosaurs and finally mosasaurs, the story repeats. They're aquatic, but they're rather ungainly swimmers. This makes sense if you assume the existence of a big deep-sea predator niche, a lineage that weathered each extinction down in the abyss, then rose to the surface during the collapse. These were the disaster taxa, the opportunists of the deep. And their presence forced every new would-be surface apex predator to evolve around them, not for speed, but for grappling, endurance, and the ability to survive being entangled by something as alien and intractable as a squid the size of a fishing boat. Unlike surface predators that vanished in the extinction, deep-sea squid didn't need to adapt. They were already massive. All they had to do was rise. In the silent oceans, after mass extinction events, the giants of the abyss simply moved upward. We came close to repeating the pattern ourselves. In our modern era, humans hunted cetaceans with such relentless precision that we nearly granted cephalopods surface dominance once again. The great whales, the only creatures with the sensory tools and bulk to keep the giants of the deep in check, were brought to the brink. Why are sperm whales called sperm whales? Because if you chop one of them open, you'll find that its head is full of slimy stuff that looks kind of like cum. Yes, that's actually why they're called that. To this day, it's not clear what the actual biological purpose of that stuff is for a whale, but for humans, it's difficult to overstate how important this whale cum, spermaceti, if you want to be fancy about it, was to the 19th century economy. Spermaceti was the high-grade stuff, but the entire blubbery mass of a whale could be melted down into whale oil, which was used for everything that we use every type of oil for these days. The main use was for fueling oil lamps. Almost everywhere there would be a light bulb today, there would have been an oil lamp fueled by whale oil. That, or a candle with wax made from spermaceti. With the Industrial Revolution in full swing, machines needed lubricants, and the best lube in the world was made from whale oil. Whale oil was still the standard for the best industrial lubricant until remarkably recently. Some parts of the Apollo spacecraft were lubed up with whale grease. And of course, another big use of oil is for cooking, and you could use whale oil for that too. Typically, food wasn't like fried in whale oil because apparently it smells nasty. Who would have guessed? But before vegetable and seed oils became the norm, margarine was made out of whale oil, too. Funny how you hear the RFK Jr. types bemoaning how everything's made out of seed oils these days, but you never hear them clamoring for a return to the days when, instead, we mostly used whale oil. You could do other stuff with other parts of the whale. The bones were ground up and used for fertilizer. You may have heard of whalebone being used for corsets, but whalebone, all one word, was a different material than whale space bone. Whalebone is not the bones of a whale, it's the baleen. Sperm whales are toothed whales, they don't have baleen. But I think I mentioned before, I mentioned this way back in my Timothy Dexter episode. Baleen, whalebone, was hugely useful, had lots of purposes, it was almost the plastic of its time.
It was tough, but flexible, so it was used for tools, military helmets, umbrella spokes, buggy wheels, all kinds of things.
Thank you, Pastor. So yeah, whaling was lucrative. Over the course of an average day, an average Westerner in the 19th century probably used several different products made of whale. Whaling mostly wasn't for meat. Other than a few Arctic indigenous tribes, historically people didn't often eat whale meat, largely because, before modern industrial whaling ships, it was fucking hard to catch a whale. In the Middle Ages, some people in Europe ate whale meat during Lent as a sort of air-budding of the Catholic Church's no-meat-during-Lent rule. They said you can eat fish, right? Because fish isn't meat, apparently, and even though whale meat is said to be more like beef than fish, which somehow makes sense to me, you know, whales are basically big wet cows, whale meat was still fishy enough to be okay during Lent. Please chime in if you've eaten whale meat. Like, do I have viewers who have eaten whale meat and are willing to admit it? Let me know. Is it like beef? Also, mostly unrelated, but in Quebec, the Catholics declared that beavers were, biblically speaking, fish too. So you could eat beaver meat during Lent. I'm going off on too much of a tangent here, but I just had to include that. But yeah, it wasn't until whaling was already a huge industry in the 19th century that countries where whaling was a big deal, like Japan and Norway, tried to sell their populace on eating whale. Mostly because otherwise they'd just be catching whales for their oil and bones and baleen and throwing all the meat back in the ocean. It caught on as a cheap substitute for beef or salmon in a few places. In fact, Japan liked whale meat enough that they're still whaling today under a flimsy excuse of scientific research, this time almost exclusively for meat. But it wasn't popular everywhere. In Britain after World War II, one of the few meats that wasn't rationed was whale meat. Despite a promising attempt at rebranding it as Waken, since apparently it can be made into something similar to bacon, nobody bought it. And by then, the great all-purpose oil that had fueled the 19th century was being replaced with other oils. Lamp oil was now kerosene, and homes were lit by electricity. For lubricants, there was WD-40. For food, now it was easier to extract vegetable oils and seed oils. Canadian farmers created the word canola to rebrand a useful oily plant with a deeply unmarketable name, rapeseed. There's a common claim, dating all the way back to the age of whaling and still heard today, that it was oil drilling that saved the whales. Here's a cartoon from 1861 showing whales celebrating the prospect of petroleum replacing whale oil. It's a fun thing to believe, and I think a very tourist cabinet of curiosities sort of factoid. I'm always on about how the world is complicated, there are trade-offs in everything, nothing is 100% good or 100% bad. I'm a pervert for nuance. And the oil industry saved the whales, the idea that the 19th century's biggest environmental problem was solved by the 20th century's biggest environmental problem, it's exactly the sort of take I would embrace, if it were true. But it's not true. Whaling kept going long after it had any real economic reason to. By the time kerosene and Edison light bulbs were replacing whale oil lamps, the Victorian corset craze was underway, driving up demand for baleen. Hydrogenation, the process of turning oil into usable cooking fat, didn't become commonplace until the 1910s, so the conversion of whale oil to margarine didn't happen at the same time that it was used in lamps. It was a new use discovered for whale oil after it was no longer being used in lamps. All the way up until the mid-20th century, humans were finding new uses for whales. The use of whale oil to lubricate the Apollo spacecraft isn't a strange, steampunkish historical juxtaposition, a sort of factoid like Abraham Lincoln could have sent a fax to a samurai, when you realize that the 1960s were the peak of the global whaling industry. Throughout this period, the Soviets were the main whaling nation, carrying on with massive and ever-growing whale hunts as recently as the late 70s. There wasn't much of an economic use for whales by then, at least not at the scale that the Soviets were pulling them up from the ocean, but so what? It was a planned economy. Production targets were set in the 5-year plans based on the number of whales that had been estimated in Arctic waters near the end of World War II. Before long, they ran out of whales in Russian waters, so the Soviet whaling fleets sailed all the way to the Antarctic. They didn't update the 5-year plans as the whales ran out. Sometimes, Russian whalers didn't even process the whale carcasses they caught. They weren't going to sell that oil, that meat, like filthy capitalists. They were catching whales because... glory to the motherland, comrade, and they got bonuses for catching more whales than the rival fleet. Meanwhile, whaling was finally in decline in the West, with the growth of the environmental movement in the 60s, as well as the reality that, sure, whaling didn't die at Spindletop, but the number of cases where the best product for the job was something made from a whale was dwindling. If you want a contrarian, pervert for nuance take about whales, it shouldn't be the oil industry saved the whales, which sounds true but isn't. It should be capitalism could have saved the whales, and communism almost wiped them out. Capitalist countries didn't have much of a use for whales by the 1970s, but the Soviets kept on killing whales by the thousands to fulfill their 5-year plans within a system of economic planning that was still designed to keep up with what Western economies were doing in the 1920s, not the present day. Capitalists tried, with some success, to create new industries for whale products to go into, once whale oil was no longer lighting houses, but under capitalism, when an industry no longer makes money, it dies. It was the communists who kept on harpooning to the bitter end. These days, Japan continues illegal whaling, but that too is driven more by national pride than profit. You can buy whale meat in Japan, but most Japanese people think it's gross and immoral. It's not a thriving industry. There's no money in whales any longer. Finally, reality intervened, even in the USSR. We only stopped whaling when there weren't enough whales left to catch. Neither capitalism, nor communism, nor oil, nor activism saved the whales. The tragedy of the commons did. The International Whaling Commission passed a global moratorium on whaling in 1982, and it went into effect in 1986. By then, sperm whale stocks numbered 1/3 of what they had been at the beginning of the 19th century. Some other species, like the Antarctic blue whales pursued by the Soviets, numbered less than 1% of what their stocks had been. Big animals reproduce slowly, so there are still far fewer of almost every species of whale now than there were 200 years ago. But they're coming back. Conservation efforts, slow and partial though they may be, held the door shut to a transformation of our oceans. Back to squid. During the period of the most intense whaling, nobody observed a change in behavior among giant squid, but giant squid are pretty damn hard to observe. There's a strong chance, if one of many historical paths had gone a different way, we could have hunted sperm whales into extinction, and giant squid, which probably don't have any other major predator, would have noticed. Despite everything, our knowledge of colossal and giant squids remains frustratingly minimal. What we do have comes from a few barely alive floaters and the half-digested remains pulled from the stomachs of sperm whales. Until 2004, no photo of a living giant squid was believed to exist. The life history we assign to them is often based on extrapolations from surface-dwelling, open-ocean squids. Fast-growing, short-lived animals adapted to high-energy ecosystems. But applying those assumptions to deep-sea giants seems increasingly questionable. Take lifespan, for instance. The idea that creatures as large as Architeuthis dux could grow to 20 feet long in just a few years implies a metabolic rate and food intake that deep-sea ecosystems could probably never sustain. The abyss is not a place of rapid turnover. It is a place of patience, scarcity, and endurance. How long do giant squid live? We're not sure, but probably awfully long. Then there's reproduction. Most known squid species die after breeding, a form of self-digestion where the body breaks itself down, pumping all remaining energy into reproductive tissues. But the curious thing is, none of the floating giant squid carcasses we've examined show signs of this post-reproductive breakdown. No bloated gonads, no degraded organs, no telltale collapse of the internal machinery. This absence strongly suggests that Architeuthis dux do not die after a single breeding event. They are likely iteroporous, meaning they have a repeating reproductive cycle rather than being fertile just once in their lives. Most deep-sea fish and sharks are iteroporous. Yeah, I don't know how to pronounce that. I am now looking up the pronunciations of things by popular demand, but sources differ on whether it's iteroporous or iteroporous. But why shouldn't giant squid be itero that? In a world where food is rare and migration is costly, dying after one reproductive attempt is an evolutionary luxury they can't afford. It's far more reasonable to imagine these creatures as the sleeper sharks of the cephalopod world, long-lived, slow to mature, reproducing multiple times across decades. They are not like their shallow cousins who burn bright and die fast. They are shaped by the deep, slow, deliberate, and built to endure. Architeuthis dux retains chromatophores, color-changing cells that most cephalopods have. That strongly suggests the giant squid retains the capacity to communicate, just like its smaller social cousins. The machinery is there, the pigment cells, the neural wiring, the memory of patterns. What's missing isn't ability, it's opportunity. In the deep sea, prey is sparse and dispersed. Cooperation is another luxury the abyss can't afford, because you're not going to find enough food to feed a whole pack of giant squid. So the giants hunt alone, not because they're incapable of cooperation, but because it's the only way that works. Right now, the chromatophores are vestigial, meaning a useless relic of a previous evolutionary form, like your appendix, which was probably used to store beneficial gut bacteria in the days before modern medicine. If you spend enough time out in the wilderness, chances are your appendix will spring back into action. And if enough giant squid rise to the surface oceans, maybe, like their close relatives the Humboldt squid, they can learn to use their chromatophores, useless in the dark depths, to communicate again. If we had fully wiped out sperm whales in the 20th century, there's a strong chance that by now, just a blink of an eye later in evolutionary time, humanity would be noticing a strange new apex predator in our surface oceans. By getting rid of its arch nemesis, we would have released the Kraken. If ever a complete disaster strikes, if the oceans empty once more and surface predators vanish in the dark, then what writhes beneath will rise again. The deep will send up its patient inheritors. Over 10 meters long, intelligent, and capable of cooperation long dormant, the giants will return not as myths but monarchs. And for millions of years, the empty oceans will be theirs.